Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Our guests this week are the absolute tops in their field. Dana Cowan has been Food & Wine Magazine's editor-in-chief for 20 years, but all that time, she's been hiding a secret. Dana reveals her secret. Then, Tony Apuganum joins us with his tale of what it took to become one of the world's top mixologists. And although you may not know Grayson Gill of Bellegarde Bakery yet, he's on his way to the top of the bread-making world. We stand among the greats on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Dana Cowan. I'm the editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine, and I have the pleasure of overseeing Food & Wine in every medium, from digital to print to books to social. And so I live and breathe the Food & Wine lifestyle 24/7.
As editor of Food & Wine magazine, Dana Cowan's life involves a lot of food, a lot of words, and a lot of photographs. Dana supervises a team of writers, helping them craft stories for the monthly publication. She breaks up her day by checking in to see what's cooking in the magazine's test kitchen. But even though the test kitchen is right across from her office, Dana's so busy putting the magazine together that she's never really mastered the art of cooking. Luckily, she's got friends in all the right places.
I have to admit to you and your listeners, yes, I've been the editor of Food & Wine for 20 years, and I am not a great cook. That is just the honest truth. Like, people, they doubt me, they push me, they say that just can't be the case. And I say, any day you talk to me, whatever I last cooked, I can tell you the mistake that I made. So I decided to write a book about my mistakes and get the great chefs around America who are friends of mine to help me with my mistakes and correct them so that I would have fantastic recipes, but also ways to make sure that nobody made the dumb mistakes that I did. You know, my worst mistake probably was almost catching the kitchen on fire. I was making a butterfly leg of lamb in the broiler in my oven, and there was too much fat, and it was too close to the broiler coils. And so, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes in, flames started licking out of my oven. I was terrified, frozen, and then realized I better move fast, otherwise the lamb was not going to be the only thing that was burned. Yeah, I've made mistakes with everything.
Well, you are a good girl to fess up and make everybody feel a little bit better about their kitchen mistakes. Yeah, how did you decide who to bring in? For instance, let's talk about Jacques Pepin, okay? I'm really envious now. I don't think that there is, if I could just watch Jacques Pepin's hands at work, I think I would be perfectly content. So
you are so right. I am with you. The way Jacques Pepin can turn a radish into a rose, anything, watching him butcher a chicken, he's so fast. He is really a master. I had Jacques help me with my souffle, which I had wanted to make my boyfriend at the time a very romantic meal, and I'd heard about how romantic souffles were, and you know that you make them for two people, so you share them, and that's the romance. But whoever perpetrated that myth, I want to know who that is, because basically souffles are finicky. So instead of spending time with the boyfriend, you're spending the time with your egg whites and whipping them. Jacques Pepin completely helped me fix that because he uses cream cheese, which I thought was sort of a miracle ingredient. It helps stabilize your eggs. So, yeah, Jacques was fabulous. And I would recommend, if anyone is worried about cooking for the boyfriend, I say make something the night before. Don't make anything the day of. Just the only thing you should need to do is reheat.
Oh, gosh, we even get romance advice in mastering my mistakes in the kitchen. So I'm a pretty good cook myself.
Yes.
And you got together with David Chang, and you discovered that flourish that you see on television and that you see people do, where they, from up in the air, just drop the seasoning like with great ceremony, that's not really pretension. There's a reason for that.
You're right. Dave Chang taught me how important it is to season with salt from up high. And the reason that they season from up high is to make sure that there's an even sprinkling of whatever the seasoning is, in this case, salt. So he actually showed me both ways. He said, you know, this is what happens if you sprinkle from on high and it all drifts down and it goes in a sort of even layer over what's below. And this is what happens if you season from, let's say, an inch or two away and you just watch. There's no room for the salt to float. So it all sort of clumps and lands in one place. And so sometimes all you need to do is see that once and you say, okay, you are not being pretentious when you are so dramatic and, you know, you are doing your salt from 1 foot up.
I loved that. And the vegetable whisperer. Now, that really made me laugh. I had never seen Alice Waters called the vegetable whisperer before. So what did she contribute to your kitchen knowledge?
Oh, Alice was so incredible. You know, when I think of Alice and cooking, I think everything that she does is quite simple and straightforward, and that is true. But there's also so much knowledge and thought behind everything. So when I was talking about blanching vegetables, she likes vegetables that are neither droopy nor stiff. And she also believes in blanching them and then never putting them under cold water. She likes to leave them to come to room temperature on their own. And I thought that was sort of a lovely tip. And she also is so deeply interested in the seasonal, that we know. But I would say she pays attention to the micro seasons. You know, I pay attention to the macro seasons. To me, there are 4 seasons. To Alice, I think there are 365 seasons.
Well, you know, I have a true confession that I can make now. I have a reoccurring nightmare, and that it's Alice is in my kitchen, and she's seen something on the counter or the open pantry that's offending her. I am so afraid of Alice coming into my kitchen. I've done all sorts of things to keep her out.
Wow, that's amazing.
Do you ever think things like that?
Well, I have definitely gotten over my embarrassment in front of chefs, considering, you know, I've told 65 of them my darkest moments in the kitchen. So not yet. I think, you know, the fear of not feeding people well, that is my biggest fear.
I'm curious, you're in the kitchen with all these great professionals. Did you find that there was a commonality that ran between them all? What makes these great people so great?
I think that all of these chefs are indeed great teachers. I think there's a commonality there because in order to be successful, you need to be able to share your craft and have other people replicate it. So they were excellent communicators, excellent teachers. And I think that they also, to the last, were able to focus and really make the dishes shine. They had an intelligence and instinct and intuition and a sort of innovation, in most cases, about the way that they thought about food. So food is a medium for creativity for all of them. And I love seeing that. You know, it's sort of, there are sculptors, there are painters, but these chefs are artists with, you know, an edible medium.
Well, you know, these chefs are your friends. Really, it's a story of cooking with friends. You just asked some friends into the kitchen to cook with you. Isn't that really what it was all about?
Well, it was fantastic to get into the kitchen with these chefs. And what was interesting was that I felt like, and I feel like, these people, guys, women, are my friends, but I know them so often outside of the kitchen. I know them from eating their food. I know them from having dinner with them. I know them from being at events with them. But being in the kitchen was so special. It deepens your relationship for sure, because they see a side of you that they don't know, and you see a side of them that you don't know. Being sort of a teacher and student is a completely different relationship than we have in the everyday world. And I really loved that, because they are fantastic teachers, and their generosity and their largeness of spirit, which I think is inherent in most people who are in the food and hospitality world, comes through so strongly. It was just a pleasure.
Dana, how did the experience of writing this book and having all of the experiences along the way, how has that changed you?
I really had to pause and think, what went wrong here? More than just burning something, or more than, you know, having an overpowering flavor, like, what was the theme? And themes did emerge, which were more about my personality than my technique. And that was an extraordinary lesson that I did not expect to have. So I learned that what I really need to do to become a better cook is to be patient and to be focused. And this is the greatest gift that the book gave me. The big difference now is that I'm more aware of the ways in which I can be a better cook and a better person.
Dana Cowan, editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine and author of Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen. In her book, Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen, Dana Cowan reveals many very personal stories about her life, including her experience during breast cancer treatment. Although the doctors had warned her that chemotherapy would cause her to lose both her hair and her appetite, it turned out that Dana was a hungry cancer patient, complete with cravings. Dana craved pot stickers and began making them herself, but although they were tasty, Dana couldn't quite achieve the yum factor of dim sum parlor dumplings. Her friend Ming Tsai came to the rescue and taught Dana an invaluable lesson. To make perfect pot stickers that are juicy with crispy browned bottoms, Ming told her to use a lot of vegetables in the filling and to brown the pot stickers twice. Once before steaming them, and then again right before serving. According to Dana's recipe, you can whip up 40 pot stickers in an hour's time. Plus, uncooked pot stickers can be frozen for up to a month and don't have to be thawed out before cooking, making homemade pot stickers a fast, fun dish. Trust me, this recipe is worth it for the dipping sauce alone. For a copy of Dana's pot sticker recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at WWNO and itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. What is the right kind of flour to use in bread baking? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the right kind of flour to use in bread baking? Flour is made up of carbohydrates, proteins, and in the case of whole wheat flour, a bit of fat. Of these three nutrients, it's the protein that matters most to bakers. The proteins in wheat are gluten-forming proteins. Gluten is what gives bread that crispy crust and satisfying chewiness. A harder flour will have a higher percentage of protein, best suited for bread. A softer flour with less protein is best for tender doughs like pie crusts, cakes, and cookies. But the protein content of wheat can vary from 5% to 16%, so how can you tell which flour to use? Luckily, the flour industry has established labeling standards to help you find the right flour for your baking needs. So read the label. But in general, whole wheat and bread flour are about 16% protein. All-purpose ranges from 10 to 12%, with cake and pastry flour coming in at the 7 to 9% range. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. ...4 a.m. is an hour reserved for the dedicated. In New Orleans' Broadmoor neighborhood, you might see a bunch of cops, a couple of delivery men, and maybe someone staggering home from a big night out. But anyone whose day starts at 4 a.m. has a purpose, a real commitment. That's the time the day begins at Bellegarde Bakery. Producer Thomas Walsh visited Bellegarde on a recent early morning.
By the time I arrived at Bellegarde Bakery at 7 o'clock, I felt like a straggler. The first person who arrived had pulled dough from the cooler, fired up the oven, and rolled out baguettes. I met head baker Grayson Gill alongside his oven, patiently focused on work. He was covered in a thin layer of flour, but that didn't bother him. He had 700 baguettes to bake and was clearly in his groove.
Right now we're scoring the bread with a razor blade, something that people have been doing for at least 3,000 years, slashing the loaf of bread right before it gets baked in the oven. It's called a bloom. So with the baguette, it's a traditional slash from top to bottom that allows that bloom and what we call the ears to open up in the oven and end up on that loaf of bread.
The blooms also create decorative patterns on the bread, a signature of Bellegarde's loaves, now a fixture at local grocery stores and farmers markets. Each year, the bakery gains more attention, as does the 27-year-old Grayson, a California native and relative newcomer to the city.
And when I got to town, for whatever reason, I just had this compulsion and this attraction to bread that I had tried baking in the house that I was staying at in the Bywater, and it definitely just kind of snowballed and accelerated from there. And I think more than anything, it was a frustration that I couldn't get things to taste or to look the way that I wanted them to, or the way that I thought they should be. So there was this compulsion, not to get it right, but at least to strive towards something more and more and more.
Is compulsion too harsh of a word? Maybe diligent is a better way to describe Grayson and his team.
For me, and I think for everybody else here, that's definitely the ultimate form of expression, is showing up 4 days a week or 7 days a week and doing the same thing day in and day out.
Life in the kitchen was punctuated by the long transfer peel that loaves were placed on before they were dropped in the oven. When Grayson needed some help with the final batches, he called on Brett, his bandana business partner, who traded in his nightlife for a baker's mitt years ago.
There's no, like, staying out all night at the bar and coming into work. You may as well just stay home at that point. It's funny going to work and during carnival or something and seeing your roommates just, like, getting home, telling them good morning, and they're really confused. They don't think it's morning yet.
The Bellegarde crew wraps up work in the early afternoon. Their final task? To take detailed notes about that day's bread.
I know some bakers will take a more kind of freestyle approach to it and get good results, and that's certainly possible if you're really talented or extremely well-experienced, you know, but got a lot of people working and not everyone works every day, so it's really important to have that way to communicate to each other. the right way to do it, I think.
This means that Brett and all the other bakers at Bellegarde can handle the responsibility of baking on their own. No supervision, no micromanaging. They can take a day off if they need it. But when you're this enamored with food, it's often hard to stop thinking about it. Here's Grayson again.
You would hope that the translation between quality food or the changing taste of food would be funneled, filtered, and explained from the top down, from the restaurant kitchens to the general public, maybe like a pyramid, but I'm learning that it's been more of an inverted pyramid where you're having such a demonstrative support from the public base that's really demanding that chefs and restaurants in general begin to carry quality products from the ice water on the table to the bread that they serve with the main meal.
I quickly learned that Grayson's pensive approach to food isn't limited to the way he cooks.
A chef is somebody that's acting more as an alchemist, and they're taking ingredients and transforming them into something that, even though it may have been edible at one point in time, they're composing and they're curating. So it's a lot more of a, I think, an imaginative profession or career, whereas producing food, like, it's a very straightforward, it's not like predicated off of how many covers you have or what's a cool trend as far as the cooking goes or whatever it may be. I mean, you need to show up every single day, 7 days a week, 6 days a week for years and years in order to hone it and get it down and to be consistent and to treat it with the respect that it deserves. I spent 6 years at the market, pretty infatuated with every single person that sells food there, with their stories and with their attitudes and with the blisters on their fingers from working so hard. And I mean, they're an incredible lot of people that really make, really create a special environment. And I can't stress again how imperative it is to get food from the people that make it. I mean, it's the same way of buying a CD or going to a concert. And I don't think you can find that anywhere else in America.
Now, I don't get the impression that Grayson was resentful towards chefs or local distributors, but he definitely felt that people who make our food are often neglected, often swept aside. So if he's right, what does that mean?
You know, it's a city of memories, and it's a city about sharing and tradition. Food is that language that we all speak, and when you just hear about it from the restaurants or from, like, the websites about who's doing the new, like, $2 million build-out, it's not like who cares, but it's like, what does that add? That's not a conversation, you know, that's kind of a scripted situation where nobody's growing and nobody's learning, because a lot of the traditions are not only in peril right now, but I think a lot of the traditions are definitely in need of some sort of enunciation or some sort of recognition and some sort of respect, and the entire paradigm needs to be changed to, I think, acknowledge and understand and comprehend people that make food by hand, what that means to us and what that means to the community in general.
Or, to channel Marshall McLuhan's famous passage,
the medium's the message, and if the medium is buying something on the internet or going to a grocery store at midnight, then the fabric's really going to lose a lot of texture that way.
Grayson explained to me that there are a lot of missed opportunities for sourcing locally. For example, next to his oven is an 8-inch furrowed mill that helps Grayson control the temperature of the grain as it's milled. He calls this a game changer.
I mean, why are we buying flour that's milled in Vermont, or why are we buying flour that's milled in Minneapolis if the grain is right by our doorstep? There's these things that you can look at through the kaleidoscope of politics. You can look at it through the kaleidoscope of agriculture, whatever it may be, but the fact is that it's the same lens on the same contraption that you're just shifting and refracting your perspective of, but at the end of the day, it's all related. And I think connecting those dots and enunciating that is imperative in order for the picture to change.
Recently, Bellegarde started sourcing salt from Avery Island and is getting whole grain wheat from as nearby as possible, even if nearby means Austin, Texas.
There's an immediacy to the decisions that a baker makes or a craftsperson makes that are tangible and that are present, and for me personally, that's the attraction. And because it involves so many different aspects, including politics or including capitalism or including, you know, international trade, and I'm attracted to that. So it definitely is about the bread for us here. It's not about proselytizing. It's not about degrading. It's not about any of those things, but it definitely is about having a conversation with people that make food and people that eat food, which coincidentally happens to be every single person and animal on the face of the earth. So there's a there's a big audience, you know. We live in a place that's so incredible, and we live in a place that's so rich. I think we have nothing but time and enjoyment to spend on rebuilding everything and putting the pieces back together, because they were never broken, I think just misplaced.
For Louisiana Eats, I'm Thomas Walsh.
Breads from Bellegarde Bakery are available at markets and grocery stores throughout the New Orleans area.
Some kind of love, a margarita total, between thought and expression.
Ian McNulty is a public radio contributor as well as a food writer for the New Orleans Advocate. He's also the author of Louisiana Rambles. Ian, what's up your sleeve today?
Well, today, Poppy, we're headed north. And when I say north, what I really mean is we're headed to the deep south. This trip starts on Highway 61, which a lot of people around New Orleans and Baton Rouge will know as Airline Highway.
That's right.
Or Airline Drive, perhaps. Well, this is a really long road that covers a lot of ground in our state. And when it emerges from Baton Rouge, that's when you know you've reached a different region. St. Francisville is the hub here. It starts to get a little hillier, gently, you know, but compared to the whole flatness of southeast Louisiana, you can immediately tell the difference that you're entering sort of a different area. Well, on a recent trip there, I immersed myself in the traditional tourism draws there, which were delightful. But when it came time to get some refreshments to eat and drink, I was really delighted to find these more eclectic places, kind of clustered together right in downtown St. Francisville, all along Commerce Street, which is one of the main drags there. And that starts with a place called the Magnolia Cafe. This is a restaurant and cafe. It looks like it could be out of a Carson McCullers novel. You know, it's this little cottage that's been added on to one little step and project and wing at a time until today when you approach it, it's like this cottage with a really big rambling screened-in deck and gazebo sort of growing off of it. If you get there when the sun has gone down a bit, all these, you know, lights have come up. It kind of gives it a honky-tonk look, real inviting. It's a very casual place. And to me, after you've been through all this Louisiana history and plantation homes and tours, it's a nice eclectic break because while the menu does have po' boys on it and some of the expected Southern standards, here you're also getting enchiladas, pizzas, one with spinach and chicken and garlic, really good, hummus, some of the lighter things like that. So it really covers a lot of bases, a real eclectic kind of cafe. If you go there on Fridays, they often have live music too. So a cool social hub. If you go there, you may see people that were on your tour of the last plantation house or maybe even gave the tour. It has that feel of the community gathering spot. Well, right next door, basically sharing the parking lot with this place, with Magnolia Cafe, is Birdman Coffee and Books. And this is a old-fashioned coffee shop, a real Java joint. You know, you can get a good, strong coffee drink here and also just kind of soak in that old coffee shop atmosphere. You know, lots of warm wood and books everywhere, that sort of thing. And if you go right across the street, there's the St. Francisville Inn, which on paper sounds like a lot of the B&Bs and hotels that they have in this area. It looks the part. It has this funky Gothic look to it with these high-peaked sort of gingerbread woodwork exterior to it and a big, deep porch. Functions as a B&B, but also it's home to the wine parlor. And this is a come one, come all wine bar, basically. You don't have to be a guest to come and enjoy this. You know, as you're wandering around from room to room, you can flop yourself on the sofa with a glass of wine or sit on the front porch and watch some of St. Francisville roll by. So between the three of those places, Magnolia Cafe, Birdman Coffee and Books, and St. Francisville Inn, all within steps of each other, really, right across the street. You can see one by looking at the others. It's sort of this eclectic hub in the middle of this really what we think of as a deeply traditional tourist destination.
What fun.
Yeah, it is a great time up there.
Sounds like you could spend the whole day right there.
Oh, it's an easily. There's a lot to see there. And, you know, if you're up for it, on the way back out, when you get back on Highway 61, look for the Audubon Lounge. It has a really funky, great dark little bar and lounge right there on Highway 61, kind of right on the edge of town there. It's just another little quirk and twist of our Louisiana towns that make them so great.
Well, thank you for bringing us the quirks and the twists today. That was delicious. Thanks, Ian.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Italian immigrants have left their mark on many communities in Louisiana, especially in New Orleans and the southeastern part of the state. But these families, many of whom were Sicilians, hailing from places like Palermo and Cefalù, also found their way to North Louisiana. Our Louisiana Eats roving reporter Chris Jay filed this report.
In Shreveport, there are Italian-owned fine dining establishments, a few historic sandwich shops with Italian roots, and a personal favorite of mine, Gullo's Fresh Produce and Bake Shop. Gullo's is an old-fashioned roadside produce stand that also serves plate lunches to go, and it's the only place I can think of that serves both chicken fried steaks and handmade cannoli. It's a little bit country, a little bit old country, and entirely unlike any other place in Shreveport. Teresa Gullo Hamilton, daughter of Gullo's founders John and Retha Gullo, still operates the business. As a child, she worked this land alongside her grandfather, a first-generation Sicilian immigrant and truck farmer.
We got up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, as soon as the sun was light enough. Right, every summer, we got paid not by the hour, but we got paid by what we produced for him at the end of the day. Now, our days were over with about 10:30 or 11 o'clock in the morning because it got hot. And we would go in and my grandmother would cook a large meal up and he would sit down in his chair and watch as the world turns.
In 1981, Teresa's parents opened a fresh produce stand on Flournoy Lucas Road in South Shreveport. Aided by the popularity of Retha's home cooking, the roadside business soon began selling hot lunches as well. Today's Gullo's is still this interesting hybrid of produce stand and plate lunch house.
They actually started this business under a pecan tree with a card table and a few tomatoes on it. My mother, who had always been such a good cook, then she started making a few things to go out there. She found that the more she made, the more people bought, and it just grew and grew and grew.
When John and Retha both passed away in 2011 after 30 years in business, Teresa and her cousin Patricia were among the family members who banded together to keep Gullo's Fresh Produce and Bake Shop alive.
When your family's gone, the stuff that you took for granted, just the daily stuff they did every day, the smells when you walk in that kitchen and you smell something and you think it brings you back 40 years ago, you know, it's pretty cool, I think.
It's still a family affair, as Teresa and Patricia are taking the opportunity to bring a new generation into the kitchen.
We're making them do it, whether they want to do it or they don't.
Yeah.
I mean,
when Craig would come home from college, I'm like, you got to work store this summer.
Well, I don't want to work store. I don't care. You're working a store. You can't be here if you don't work, okay? Like, that's just a deal we have.
If there's any dish that embodies the Gullo story of Sicilian immigrants becoming true blue Southerners, it's the family's recipe for cherry cannoli. Unlike many versions, which use ricotta cheese for the filling, the Gullo's version is filled with a simple custard flavored with chopped maraschino cherries. Biting into one for the first time, I crunched through the crispy pastry tube dusted with powdered sugar and into that custard filling, which instantly reminded me of every dessert my Arkansas-raised grandmother brought to family get-togethers.
I've met chefs from all over the place, you know, at different restaurants and stuff, and they all have that same basic ricotta cheese, and I'm like, where'd that come from? Because we didn't have that, you know?
I don't know if our relatives couldn't afford the cheese back then.
and they just made it work with what they had. We didn't have these all the time. Like, I don't remember my grandmother making these, like, just every Sunday or something. It was like a special occasion day when we had them.
Usually, when I stop in at Gullo's, I get one of their fantastic cheeseburgers and eat it at a picnic table in the pecan grove that surrounds the little shop. I can never help wondering how this place has hung on, even as more and more restaurants have opened nearby. Selling a box of cannoli here, a jar of Mayhaw jelly there, how do they do it? Maybe the better question is, why do they do it?
I've had people come along and say, why do you keep that place open? Why would we close this place? It's our family, you know. It's love. It's what we do. It's not about how much money you make, because I'm going to tell you, it's not, you're not getting rich here. It's just about what you do. So, it's you know, when we do the traditional things like the St. Joseph spaghetti and stuff, it's all we can do to just keep doing that, because it's what keeps our hearts alive and keeps that stuff going within us.
For Louisiana Eats, I'm Chris J.
To find out more about what's happening in Shreveport, visit Chris J's blog at 20by49.com.
I have kissed you, so I'll miss you. On the road, I'll be wanting you. But I have you, cause I love you. And you have me, cause you love me too. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tony Abuganum. I'm the founder of The Modern Mixologist out of Las Vegas, Nevada. I've spent the last 34 years of my life behind bars, and I've had a smashing time doing it. I'm the author of two books, The Modern Mixologist, Contemporary Classic Cocktails, and Vodka Distilled, The Modern Mixologist on Vodka and Vodka Cocktails.
If you want to learn about the past and the future of the cocktail industry, mixologist Tony Abuganum is the man to talk to. Widely considered to be one of the world's leading bar professionals, Tony's unique perspective originated with an early immersion in cocktail culture. We recently sat down with Tony to discuss his life behind the bar and how he came to call himself a modern mixologist.
Well, a modern mixologist, Poppy, is really a play on words, if you will, because everything that I believe in is founded in the classics. I grew up in a bar family. My cousin Helen David opened the Brass Rail Bar in 1937. So 3 years after repeal of prohibition, her and her mother turned an ice cream parlor into a saloon. And it was a classic bar. It was a classic neighborhood bar. My earliest memories are with my father taking me into the Brass Rail and seeing my Uncle Charlie and my cousin Tony behind the bar in their starch white shirts and having a kiddie cocktail, a Roy Rogers or a Shirley Temple and a bag of chips, and just being in awe, the big beautiful mirrors and the crystal and the mahogany and the lights. But my introduction to bartending was under Helen's watchful eye, and she taught me the classics. So I learned old fashions and grasshoppers and pink squirrels and sidecars at an early age. And that was really my introduction to the craft. So the modern mixologist really is contemporary classic cocktails.
Well, from your point of view, because that's an amazing life's view, tell me how you have watched the evolution of the cocktail.
Well, it's been an amazing journey, as you can imagine. Starting off in 1980, at a time when being a bartender was not really one of the professions in the culinary world to aspire to. Unfortunately, I think we were still feeling the effects that prohibition had on our profession. And bartending was, you know, that part-time job, that thing you did while you were finishing school or working on your acting career. I mean, if one more person asked me, you know, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a bartender. Well, what do you want to do? well, I don't know. I'm having a pretty good time being a bartender. Well, in 1993, I had moved from San Francisco to New York City to be an actor. so I was one of those people who, okay, I guess I should be doing something else. And I'd always done theater, and So I'm going to move to New York and make it on Broadway. So I ended up bartending. and it was the year that I met Dale DeGroff, was in 1993 at the Rainbow Room. At this point, I'd been working behind bars for 13 years and pursuing a career in acting. And then I met Dale at the Rainbow Room, and I watched him work, and I watched his guests watching him work, and a light bulb went off. And it just, at that point, I realized I wanted to become the best bartender I could be. And it was long before there were any radio shows of people talking about cocktails or bartending or book deals or TV appearances. It was just about being a great bartender. And that was really the turning point in my career. And from that day forward, I just set out to be the best bartender that I could be. And, you know, it's funny, when you really commit yourself, you no longer are working for a living. You're doing what you love for a living. And it made doors started to open. I was at the right place at the right time with the right message. Having a theatrical background has been very beneficial because I get asked to speak a lot in front of big groups, both consumers and bartenders.
So, and when you're behind the bar, you're really entertaining people. Well, you're putting a show on.
We absolutely are. As Harry Denton said, the bar is the largest stage in the world, and your audience changes nightly. And it's, it's so true. You're entertaining. And that's why I think it takes a certain personality to be a great bartender.
You're very closely associated with the U.S. Bartenders Guild. So where does the Bartenders Guild fit into that picture?
Well, when I returned from New York City in 1995, after having this experience with Dale, this revelation, I just really wanted to, you know, what's out there? What's available to me to accreditate our profession? What governs the body of the bartender? And at that time, all I could find was the United States Bartenders Guild. And there was one chapter, the Southern California chapter. So I immediately joined. That was in 1996. I've been a member since 1996. The meetings were held down in Southern California. Most of the members at that time were in their 70s. And they, God bless them for keeping it alive, because there was a time when most states had a chapter, and I'm not sure what happened. Maybe most of the members died off, but today I'm very, very proud to say that we have chapters in over 40 cities around the country. It is a force to be reckoned with. We have international competitions and meetings, and you know, we internationally are governed by the IBA, the International Bartenders Association. So it's this family. You know, I go to Brazil and I call up the Brazilian president, and boom, doors open, and I know people instantly. You know, if anyone's looking to become involved, and if you don't have a local chapter, you have a fabulous chapter here in New Orleans, and it really is a wonderful organization, not only to support our industry, but to accredit our industry. And there is an accreditation through the USBG that is similar to that of the Court of Master Sommeliers that in some way legitimizes what we do as a profession.
I am fascinated by your career in entertainment, basically, because you went to New York to become an actor. You didn't become an actor, but you've been spending a lot of time on the little screen in our homes. And I'm really curious how cocktails became part of the Food Network's Iron Chef competition.
Well, I had met Mario Batali when I moved to New York City in 1993 to be an actor, as you mentioned. And I was his first bartender at his first restaurant, Poe, on Cornelia Street. And then as the Food Network came into being and Mario got on the show and Iron Chef evolved, it was with him that I did the first Iron Chef in 2007, which was Battle Mango. And it was just really, it was a wonderful episode. It was another element to the show, pairing the cocktails with the food that Mario was making, utilizing the secret ingredient. It was great. And it took a few years before they had me back on for two more battles with Charlotte Voysey. And we did two more episodes. And everyone just seemed to enjoy that element of it. You know, it was just one more kind of add-on. And food and drink, that's a wonderful things.
What was the most fun to you of your Iron Chef competition? What's the moment that really stuck with you?
Well, I think it was with Mario Battle Mango when I actually brought a still on stage and redistilled mango with vodka into kind of an eau de vie, and it was delicious. But I think the Food Network got a few, because they asked me when I came back to please not bring the still again. I don't know if we broke some laws or not. But
well, Las Vegas is your home.
Yes.
You live in Las Vegas. And from your point of view, do you think Las Vegas is the new home of the cocktail?
Well, you know, Las Vegas has always been, as New Orleans has been, an entertainment destination. All elements of entertainment, dining, shows, shopping. Really, the cocktail was an afterthought for many years. It was the big daiquiris, frozen daiquiris in the Eiffel Tower plastic souvenir glasses.
Like a New Orleans hand grenade.
Kind of, yeah. Those things have their place. They really do. But it was Steve Wynn in 1998 who hired me. His vision was we wanted to bring back the craft of the cocktail to Las Vegas. And I was the one that was lucky enough to have gotten that job. So really, this whole resurgence that we're enjoying right now was just in its infancy. It was just kind of getting started. And I had returned to San Francisco. I had been with Harry Denton at the Starlight Room, and we were doing fresh, handcrafted cocktails and getting some attention and focus on it. And I think that's how Mr. Wynn found me and brought me to Las Vegas. And I just implemented that same program, but I didn't really realize that we had over 200 bartenders on staff, 250 cocktail servers, and all eyes were on the Bellagio, not only Las Vegas or nationally, but internationally, because what Mr. Wynn created there was, you know, it really swung the pendulum.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
He reset the bar in a lot of ways.
And I think that was the start of, you know, fresh cocktails and handcrafted cocktails and bringing back the art of the bartender from just pushing buttons, rum and coke, you know, frozen daiquiri, pina colada, and doing, you know, wonderful fresh drinks. And now every casino has got a mixologist. They have a program. They're doing fresh drinks. Every restaurant, great cocktails to go along with the food. And I'm very, very proud of what's going on in Las Vegas.
But it must be very rewarding to feel like the godfather of the Las Vegas cocktail.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. But it makes me very proud to see what's going on in Las Vegas.
Famed mixology pioneer, Tony Abuganim. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll tour Shreveport's Great Raft Brewery with Andrew Nations.
This is a 20-barrel brewery, so that's 700 gallons of beer every time we brew it. So 40 kegs worth of beer. Right now, we're brewing 3 or 4 times a week, which is twice as much as we thought we'd be at this point in the business. Shreveport was really, really thirsty, even more so than we thought.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to managing producer Thomas Walsh and associate producer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.